Turning now to the second book of Samuel, chapter 18 and verse 19. 2 Samuel, chapter 18, verse 19. And we continue with our studies in spiritual lessons from the life of David. And verse 19 reads, "Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, let me run and bear the king tidings, how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies. Absalom is dead. And now King David, who is at Mahanaim, must be told. And Zadok's son, the young priest, Ahimaaz, wants to be the one to take this tremendous news of deliverance. And it is tremendous news. The men of Judah, for David, or at least his foreign mercenaries, and such people as could be raised, were outnumbered in that battle in the wood of Ephraim, something like 10-1. Well, that's a guess, but that's the kind of ratio you might expect with Israel against Judah. And it was no foregone conclusion, and there was every reason for terror and alarm, but God so moved that the forces supporting Absalom were routed, defeated, and Absalom himself perished. And so the news is to be brought back to David. And the inspired chronicler makes something of a meal regarding how this is done, and really builds us up to the point where the news reaches David, with details that you might think were not very necessary for us, but we're being prepared for a shock. That's the point of it all. And so Ahimaaz, the young priest, who is evidently, from the record, an expert runner and probably the best in the land, wants to carry the tidings. And verse 20, Joab, David's general, said unto him, "Thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day. But this day thou shalt bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead." And he makes it very plain to Ahimaaz that he cannot be the runner. Then said Joab to Cushai, his Ethiopian attendant, possibly even one of the 10 who had finally executed Absalom, but that Cushai was his very diplomatic attendant, "Go tell the king what thou hast seen." And Cushai bowed himself unto Joab and ran. But Ahimaaz is very impatient in the 22nd verse, and he appeals again to Joab, "But howsoever, let me, I pray thee, also run after Cushai." And Joab demanded, "Wherefore wilt thou run, my son, seeing that thou hast no tidings ready?" Evidently Cushai had been prepared with a very careful statement, and we see the nature of it in due course. Because Joab knew that David would be consumed with grief over the death of Absalom, a disproportionate grief, and his reaction couldn't be anticipated. And verse 23, "Nevertheless, Ahimaaz insists that he goes, and he takes a different route from Cushai," the details of that we can't tell, "and outran," or overran here, Cushai. And then the scene goes back to Mahanaim, the walls of the city. David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate unto the wall, and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. Ahimaaz was way out in front, a very considerable journey. And the watchman cried, you see, we're given such a build-up to this, and told the king. And the king said, "If he be alone, there is tidings," that is to say, good tidings, "in his mouth." King David's assumption was that if there was a general retreat, and if there had been a collapse of his forces, well, then people would be retreating together. And verse 26, "Then Cushai was spotted way behind him," not recognized, of course. "And he also bringeth tidings," and the double delivery of the tidings is brought. And see the significance of this. Verse 27, "Methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok," so well known was evidently the champion of Judah. And the king said, he is a good man and cometh with good tidings. And Ahimaaz calls, evidently he's got enough breath left even to shout up at the gate before he fully arrives. And on arrival he says, all is well. And as a young priest should, he fell down to the earth upon his face before the king, and his first words were, blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king. And David doesn't seem to be the slightest bit interested in what's become of his troops and the victory itself. Verse 29, the first thing he can say is the young man Absalom safe? And Ahimaaz answered, well, he answered dishonestly. He wasn't prepared for this. He didn't know what to say. And he said, when Joab sent the king's servant and me, thy servant, I saw a great tumult, but I knew not what it was. And King David, verse 30, brushes him aside impatiently. The king said, turn aside, stand here. And he turned aside and stood quite still, and Cushai came. Verse 31, tidings, my lord the king, gave a similar message. And the king said again, is the young man Absalom safe? And Cushai's superb answer, surely prepared by Joab, the enemies of my lord the king and all that rise up against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is. And the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son, my son Absalom, listen to this. Would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son. And the long build-up in the narrative is to show us the unseemly reaction of David. Now David is a great hero of ours, and he was truly a wonderful man, and he was a great king. And he did exceptional things, and he walked with the Lord, and he had tremendous faith, and his godliness and his accomplishments were well beyond telling. But the scripture tells us too about his faults and his flaws. And here is just an occasion when really he was very seriously in the wrong. He entirely failed to control his feelings. Now, there's a great lesson here for us. If someone so strong and so godly and so full of faith as David could fail at a time of testing in the way he is going to be said to fail, well, then we all have to be careful and watch out. He didn't take his royal responsibility. He was king. He should have reacted as a king should react. There were many people who'd fought for him, who'd risked their lives, who'd gone out for him knowing they were on the, well, humanly speaking, side that was bound to lose. There were so few of them by comparison with the Israelites. And these bold men had gone out and they deserved so much praise and consideration and such relief from the king's heart that they were preserved and they were safe. But he didn't now act as a king. He had no care for them, no concern for them. All his feelings were for his son, his unworthy son, his rebel, treacherous son. And he seriously lets down his leadership responsibility. Of course, it's easy for us to say, but he should have taken himself in hand. And he failed to. He had an office to fulfill for the Lord. He was king over God's people, and he should give leadership and encouragement. He gives no thanksgiving. He doesn't echo the call of the young priest to give thanks for God. He shows no relief for loyal men. He seems to have no gratitude to them. He elevates the unworthy one, the rebel, who would have brought so much death and confusion and had already brought death and confusion. He doesn't reason within himself, what am I doing? Should I be taking this position? Should I be overcome by just my own concerns and my own grief at a time like this? His reasoning was obscured entirely. So David fails at this point, and the place goes into mourning. Look at chapter 19. It was told Joab, "Behold, the king weepeth and mourneth for Absalom." And the victory that day was turned into mourning unto all the people. As the troops came in at the city gate, they couldn't believe it. There was such an atmosphere of misery. For the people heard that day how the king was grieved for his son, so grieved with unrestrained emotion. And the narrative goes on to describe it. The people got them by stealth that day into the city, as people being ashamed steal away when they flee in battle, in defeat. They felt they'd lost. But the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom." Well, dear friends, what a state to be in for David, representing the nation, the land at such a time. Reminds you of a number of things. When you read the history of the Christian church, sometimes wonderful things happen. There's a great outpouring of revival. But somewhere in the land, among some people who are Christian people, there will be fighting and squabbling over some entirely secondary and meaningless thing. Some preacher has had his ego punctured and deflated because he wasn't getting the major share of the blessing or something like that. And he kicks up an enormous fuss, and you can scarcely believe it. But you read, sometimes we are capable of, as Christians. And sometimes it happens in churches. There'll be a time of great blessing. I'm not hinting at anything in our fellowship that I know of, but sometimes you'll have a time of great blessing, and somewhere in the corner of the church there'll be somebody engaging in a petty feud. And we'll be putting our own feelings and comforts or discomforts first. So we have to be careful how we behave always. Some are teenagers. In teenagers, you get seized by very strong passions. Oh, dear friends, take advantage of teenage and curb your passions and learn to control them and learn to reason them down into reasonable proportion. Because if you conquer by the blessing of God in teenage, you'll be a strong person in controlling your passions all your life. Well, David didn't on this occasion, and it was a tragedy. Sometimes, and I don't want to hurt people who suffer from depression, which has a kind of almost chemical basis in them, and they can't help it, but there are sometimes we suffer from depression because we just don't control our self-pity. And we let things go round and round in our heads until we go down and down and down, and then we can't think straight, and we're utterly miserable. Well, here is a lesson on controlling feelings. David was a king, and his assignment was to edify, encourage, and lead, and be grateful for God's deliverance of the whole land. Now, we're a kingdom of priests, and that's always our calling, to control ourselves. In the office, wherever we are, we control our feelings and our behaviour, so that we react in a way that is fitting and right and appropriate for a representative of the kingdom of God. And it's a tragedy that on this occasion David failed. But I don't want to detract from one of the great heroes of the Old Testament. Verse 5 of chapter 19. Joab came into the house to the king and said, and he rebukes the king very severely. And his rebuke, why, must have been difficult for David to be so rebuked by proud Joab. Joab was so haughty. Joab was a murderer, and shortly he's going to murder again. David would have loved to get rid of Joab because he was such an ungracious and haughty character, but he couldn't. He was too powerful in the land, too significant to the people. But to have to be told in this way and rebuked by Joab of all people, thou hast shamed, verse 5, this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life, and the lives of thy sons, and of thy daughters, and the lives of thy wives, and so on. Verse 6, in that thou lovest thine enemies, and hatest thy friends. And this reasoning is powerful, for thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all we had died this day, then it had pleased thee well. And so Joab commands the king, now therefore arise, go forth, speak comfortably unto thy servants. And look at this threat. Is Joab saying he will walk out and half David's army will walk out with him? Or is he warning David about natural consequences? For I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, there will not tarry one with thee this night, and that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now. Many people think that's almost a personal threat. But verse 8, David comes to his senses. The rebuke comes from the last person he would like to be rebuked by. But now he acknowledges that it's right and it's justified, and he buckles in his feelings. David recovers. Do we recover if we're lost in some passion or anger or self-feeling or pity or something? He recovered himself and sat in the gate. And they told unto all the people, saying, behold, the king doth sit in the gate. He'd resumed his royal responsibilities. And the people were so relieved, and all the people came before the king. Now down to verse 9. And in verse 9, there is still considerable trouble among the tribes of Israel, the 10 tribes. There's great argument among them. Well, Absalom is dead. Our rebellion has fizzled out. Remember, they're rebelling against David because, among other things, I think they wanted moral liberty, and they wanted the glamour of Absalom, and they wanted to be less spiritual as a nation. But now there are odds among themselves, and some are saying, we must go back to David and one nation. And others were resisting because there was quite an argument. But the reasoning they used was not very good. The people for David in verse 9 say this: the king saved us out of the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines. And now he has fled out of the land for Absalom. And Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now therefore, why speak ye not a word of bringing the king back? When you read that, it's very sad. They're not saying to themselves, how foolish we've been. David has been a godly king, and he supported in every sense the spiritual purpose and mission and constitution of the land. All they're interested in, well, David wasn't so bad. He did deliver us from the Philistines, and he fought our battles for us. So we've still got our orchards and our fields and our vineyards, and we've got our prosperity and our substance. So he's not so bad. They're only thinking of themselves. There doesn't seem to be a glimmer of interest concerning their spiritual status and significance and mission in the world. It's very sad when you read these type of things and the slim basis on which they wanted him back. Oh, in the New Testament, isn't it wonderful? We've got a regenerate church membership, or as well as we can expect to have one. And the Lord has reorganized things. And no longer is it the mixed multitude of ancient Israel and Judah, with saved and unsaved all mixed together. And though it's a church and a religious nation, the majority of the people are probably unsaved. And so you get all these shocks and horrors where the people aren't thinking spiritually or interested in spiritual things. How gracious of the Lord now in the New Testament era. He calls his people out and gathers them together in saved families. I'm not thinking of all the liberal churches and all those others, but Bible-believing churches. And there are different motives. I feel sorry sometimes even for godly Presbyterianism. There are many godly Presbyterian churches who believe the gospel and the doctrines of the faith. But in no time at all, they become a mixed multitude because they baptize all the babies and they grow up, and many of them are not saved, but they're still members of the church so often. And so all kinds of troubles arise and things go wrong. And the Church of England, the same. Well, in history, there have been many godly preachers in the Church of England in their history. But because everybody in the parish is a member, it's like ancient Israel. If there are problems and squabbles and people go wrong and archbishops appear who scarcely believe in anything that matters and they want to disobey the Bible and bring in gay bishops and all the rest of it, well, all these things happen. And the believers have to suffer the consequences, the believing minority. Well, you see, it's so foolish and unnecessary because God has swept that away and he brings us together in regenerate churches. And we shouldn't have that unhappiness where most of the people are not interested in the spiritual mission and purpose of the church. But poor David, he had to put up with that in his day, that you couldn't be sure of the spiritual standing of the people. Well, look down to chapter 19, and I must hurry, at verse 11. Nobody asked for David to come back. Some of the Israelites were beginning to say, why doesn't David resume command? Why didn't he? Why didn't David return to Jerusalem and just pick up the pieces and carry on? It's one of the interesting things about this narrative is David clearly wasn't going to do that. He wanted to go back by proclamation, by the will of the people. If you like, though they didn't have voting slips and papers or anything like that, what you're looking at in chapter 19 is actually the first democracy. Believe it or not, David would not return to Jerusalem until there was general acclamation and support for him to do so. He did not want to go back as a conqueror. He wanted to go back as the rightful king whom God had appointed with the full support of the people. And he waits. Now, unfortunately, noble as that view was, he could have waited forever because his own people, the people of Judah in Jerusalem, seem to be so dense they don't think of calling for him. Come back, David. And stirring up the leaders, didn't think, look, we've got to put out the call. You've got to have some leadership. Whatever was the matter with them? And so David has to almost half fix it himself. Verse 11 of chapter 19. And the King David sent to Zadok, who needed a bit of a wake up, and to Abiathar the priest, saying, speak unto the elders of Judah, saying, why are ye the last to bring the king back to his house, seeing the speech of all Israel is come to the king, even to his house? Ye are my brethren, ye are my bones and my flesh. Wherefore then are ye the last to bring back the king? And finally, they did. They woke up and they got things organized. And they organized a formal request to the king to return and all the facilities to do it. And when he did, all Israel and Judah was with him. And so he resumed by proclamation. And of course, he did it through the guidance of God. And the guidance of God to David was partly given to him because in this respect, David is a type of Christ. He is in many ways a type of Christ, a picture of the coming Christ, who is our King by demand. We want him. We call for him. We long for him to come to our hearts, to return at the end of time, to take us into his kingdom, to take our hearts and rule over us. Now, verse 13, David issues a strange proclamation. Say you to Amasa, art thou not of my bone and of my flesh? Who's he? Well, you remember him. He's the person who acted as general for the other side. And art thou not of my bone? Come back and be my general instead of Joab. Well, that was going to make trouble. Joab wouldn't put up with that, and he didn't for long. And Amasa was appointed to be the general of David's forces, and there would be catastrophe through this. Be captain of the host in the room of Joab. Very curious decision. Obviously a political decision. David no doubt calculated that if the person who had been the general of the rebels became his general, then the rebels would far more comfortably come back and have confidence and realise that no repercussions were going to be mounted and they would be safe. But it was a disaster for two reasons. Not only because Amasa had been a traitor and he didn't deserve it, but because he'd never been proved. And he proved to be no good, and we'll see that in due course. Verse 14, and he, David, bowed the heart of all the men of Judah, even as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word unto the king, return thou and all thy servants. So the king returned. But there was trouble. And, well, before that, I'll come to Shimei in verse 16 of chapter 19. This is the Benjamite who'd symbolically thrown stones and dust across the valley towards David and yelled at the top of his voice the most diabolical insults to him and cursed him. And now Shimei, who was a Saulite and had been against David, he hurriedly came down with 1,000 men to meet King David at the River Jordan and to be among the first to do homage to him. And he repents of his crimes and his sins, and very wholeheartedly, it would seem. Verse 18, there went over a ferry boat to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. And Shimei fell down before the king as he was come over, and here are his fulsome words. Let not my lord impute iniquity unto me, neither do thou remember that which thy servant did perversely. No excuses, he owns it all. The day that my lord the king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take it to his heart, and he repents. And Abishai, who wanted to take his life before, demands it again. His life should be taken. And verse 22, David says, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? He rejects Abishai's claim to put to death this man, and he says he'll be forgiven. Verse 23, he says to Shimei, thou shalt not die, and the king swear unto him. Well, the attitude of David is going to be mercy wherever he can extend it. And he's going to be very magnanimous. And of course he must be, because if he put to death Shimei, then there'd be another reaction from the Israelites. And they'd say, well, what's going to happen to us? We were rebels too, thousands and thousands of us, tens of thousands of us. And if Shimei is put to death, there's no hope for any of us. So David is able to demonstrate his mercy. This Shimei, by the way, sounds to me like a pretty dreadful character who, through the rest of his life, I think must have gone on engaging in all sorts of subversive behaviour, because David, on his deathbed, more or less says to Solomon, I should not leave you with that man on your hands. He's a menace. Punish him early in your reign for all that he's done. And he loses his life. So this man took the mercy that David extended, but one would think he wasn't worthy of it, and he didn't behave well even after receiving it. You might have read the passage about Mephibosheth from verse 24. Sometimes this troubles people. There's Mephibosheth, the lame man, and all Saul's property that remained had previously been given to him by David, but Ziba, his servant, He lied to David that Mephibosheth had stayed behind in Jerusalem, aiming to be king once David was defeated, something of that kind. And he'd severely discredited Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth now comes to say to David, "This is not true. I've been misrepresented. I was not able to follow. My servant Ziba misled me, and he slandered me." And then, all the way down to verse 29, there's a verse which disturbs people. "And the king said unto Mephibosheth, Why speakest thou any more of thy matters? I have said, Thou and Ziba divide the land." And some Bible commentaries and study Bibles, they say, well, how sad. David made a big mistake there. Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, who he'd taken to his own table, and he knew him well, this cripple man, now he says, in effect, "I don't believe you, Mephibosheth. I don't believe what you say to me, so I can't be bothered with this case. I'm going to divide the land between you and between your servants." Whereas the better reading of what King David said is this, verse 29. "The king said unto him, Why speakest thou any more of thy matters? I have said, Thou and Ziba divide the land." And the best reading of this, I believe, is that David puts the situation back where it was. And he says, "Mephibosheth, the land is yours, and Ziba is to look after it." And the division comes along those lines. What I said before stands. The land is yours, and Ziba, well, we'll have mercy upon him, but he must till it and watch it with his servants and keep it for you. And Mephibosheth, in verse 30, says, "Let him take it all." But this was not acted upon. It all became Mephibosheth. He wasn't interested in land. He was interested in the king. But verse 31, here's a fine example of dedication. Barzillai. There are two notable Barzillais. This man was a very elderly man, a Gileadite. Verse 31. And he put all his substance at the disposal of David. David had fled from Jerusalem, and with him had gone paid foreign mercenaries and various other people. But he took no means with him, and he set up camp in due course in Mahanaim, and an army was gathered, such as they could, with the foreign mercenaries, and everything had to be paid for, and that's a very expensive business. And who paid for it? Barzillai, entirely. This rich man stood totally behind David. Now, what was in it for him? And the answer is nothing. David is going to say to him, "You put everything at my disposal. You fed my army, you supplied it, you supplied the supply lines, everything. And you must come and take your position at court." But Barzillai was an old man. He said, "Oh, king, I cannot do that. I can't even taste the food and the delicacies you have at court. My senses have gone. I am at home and I'm preparing to die." Barzillai didn't support the king because there was any peerage in it for him or any reward or anything of that kind. In fact, he put himself at considerable risk. As I keep saying, by all normal reasoning, David would lose. He was fantastically outnumbered. Absalom was bound to win and gain the land. And here is a wealthy old man putting his neck on the line and spending everything on David to support him because he loved the Lord. And he knew that David was the Lord's anointed. And David must be supported, whatever the risk, whatever the cost, whether there was nothing in it for him, and everything was put at risk. And that's the example of Barzillai. That's an example of Christian consecration, isn't it? Everything for the Lord, no matter what the risk to us, what the loss, what the cost may be, And you get a beautiful and a shining example of that in Barzillai down there in 2 Samuel chapter 19. But I'd like to go on, and because it's getting late, I'll just go on to chapter 20. There happened to be there a man of Belial whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew a trumpet and said, "We have no part in David." What had happened was that the people of Judah had brought David all the way back to Jerusalem, and the Israelites were squabbling again. The tribes of Israel, Ephraim and all the others, they said, "We were not called to play any part in this ceremony or to pay any expenses. We've been cut out. Those people of Judah are going to hog the attentions of the king and get all the favours and so on." Now, that had never happened before. King David has always been absolutely even-handed with the whole nation. But their elders feel slighted because they haven't been called into the ceremonials. Well, maybe that was an oversight. Maybe that was unfortunate. But they've just been in rebellion under Absalom. They seem to have got over that, and they said, "No, David, after all, is the man for us." And as soon as there's a ceremonial error, they're ready to go after the first person who says, "Let's resume rebellion." And I must start to come to conclusion, but this is what happens. Sheba, who's described as a worthless man, blows a trumpet and says, "We have no part in David, neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." And they did. They followed him, lock, stock and barrel. And verse 4, the king says to Amasa, his new general, "Assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days, and be thou here present." And verse 5 of chapter 20, Amasa fails to do that. Difficult to know why he failed, whether it's because the men of Judah said, "We're not getting behind this man who was until recently our enemy general," or whether it was because Amasa was just ineffective. Most people think Amasa was ineffective. Well, it's not surprising. He'd never had a success in his military career. He'd never been any good. How he got appointed, well, it was a political error, really, on David's part. Let's not do that in the kingdom of God, appoint people for political reasons. When C.H. Spurgeon had his pastor's college, the first qualification he required from anybody who applied to study at it was this. The first question on the application form: have you won souls? And that's how we have to think. Are we qualified for the Lord's work? Are we witnessing? Have we had our prayers answered and been used of God? And it would have helped if Amasa had been proved first. And so David, realizing that Amasa's no good, in verse 6, goes to Abishai, who was the brother of Joab. That's going to enrage Joab all the more. He is not going to appoint Joab. And he says to Abishai, "Get the paid mercenaries and Joab's men." They're described in verse 6. "Take thou thy Lord's servants," that's Joab's crack regiment, "and pursue after this man Sheba. Because if he gets to walled cities, well, then he'll get a foothold and escape us and raise this rebellion, and he'll be more trouble than Absalom." And Abishai took out Joab's force and the Kerethites and the Pelethites, the hired mercenaries, and they went out of Jerusalem. And then you read of the murder of Amasa by Joab. Well, what do you make of that in verse 8? Most people think that Joab, with all his typical craftiness, had a short sword, more like a long dagger, and he put it in a sheath, you know the story here, which was much too big for it, so that when he jolted or bent down or something in front of a mesa, the sword would fall on the floor and he'd have to pick it up, and a mesa wouldn't realise that he was just about to be assassinated. And he goes to kiss him, takes his beard by the side of the face and stabs him. And so Joab murders another rival. But he takes the troops and he goes after Sheba, the rebel. And then you go all the way down to verse 14, and they come to the city of Abel, and they laid siege to the city, verse 15 of chapter 20. A remarkable event, you must have read it, verse 16 of chapter 20. Then cried a wise woman out of the city, "Hear, hear, say, I pray you, unto Joab, come here, near hither, that I may speak with thee." And a wise woman, is she an elder of some sort in the city, begins to negotiate with Joab for the life of the city. Remarkable, asks Matthew Henry, where were the elders? Where were the men? Didn't any of them think of negotiating with Joab and offering them the head of Sheba to save the city? Matthew Henry's bemused by this, and he utters one of his glorious comments, "Though the man be the head, it does not follow that he has the monopoly of the brains." And it's a woman of the city who comes out and offers to Joab, "Hast hang on, and we'll throw his head over the wall." And that's exactly what happens, and it puts an end to the rebellion. And then finally, in chapter 21, and we'll close with this because there's a spiritual lesson here. Then there was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year, and David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, "It's because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he slew the Gibeonites." Now, there's no mention of this in the record of Saul in these in the biblical account of Saul's life, but these verses tell us and explain in a nutshell what happened. Evidently, at some time in his reign, Saul decided to exterminate entirely the Gibeonites. Now, the Gibeonites, 400 years before, had by trickery got an agreement, a pact, out of the Jews that their lives would be spared. And a solemn oath was drawn up and a covenant. And it was agreed that the Gibeonites, as long as they served Israel, served as vassals to Israel, could continue in the land. And they had done so, and they had largely kept their side of the agreement for 40 years. I mean, only one or two little exceptions were docile and obedient and helpful to the children of Israel. But Saul appears, without any justification, to have got it into his head to carry out genocide and to get rid of them all. Possibly it was because their territory was in Saul's territory, the territory of his tribe, the tribe of Benjamin. That's where these Gibeonites and Gibeah was, and the Gibeonites largely lived. And so possibly he tried to ingratiate himself with his own tribal elders and with all of Israel. It shows the state of Israel that if somebody smashed a 400-year-old agreement drawn up before the Lord and in the name of the Lord, then they would be pleased because they'd get the land and so on. But anyway, Saul evidently tried this. He wasn't entirely successful because the Gibeonites or many of their descendants are still there. But obviously many were killed, and there's tremendous resentment. And this is a diabolical act on the part of the Israelites to have attempted to get rid of the Gibeonites. It's tempting to say when this would have taken place in the reign of Saul. Possibly while he was chasing David in the final years. Possibly he had several shots at it, but it was because of Philistine oppression he had to abandon it, and the Gibeonites survived. But anyway, Verse 2, David inquired of the Lord, rather, in verse 1, and the Lord said, it's because of the way Saul treated the Gibeonites. You're in famine. 1 year of famine you can withstand. Maybe 2 years, but 3 years, people begin to die, and it's really dangerous, and everybody is in poverty and in trouble. Why hadn't David inquired earlier? I think we can fairly say that David should have guessed, and so should the elders. This was a terrible blot on the history of the people of Israel, that they'd done this thing. And I think it's fair to say, but this is only a guess, that the trouble, in a small way, was still going on. And that Saul's few descendants were still riding roughshod over Gibeonites in their territory, in their neck of the woods. And that's why it's absolutely fair, but this is only presumption, that they should be included and they should be put to death. Well, God says it's because of this ongoing terrible deed towards the Gibeonites, with whom there was an agreement. For end of verse 3. Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. He was trying to get favour by destroying this remaining nation. So verse 3, David says to the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? And they demand that no compensation, no land, nothing like that, but that the descendants of Saul should be held to account. We may say, would this be fair? Because would the descendants of Saul have personally had any responsibility? And that's, I would say, as a guess, probably yes, that this was being continued. That there were many people like Shimei who were still Saulites and still wanted his policy and his ways to be continued. So there were seven of them. The perfect number. Not that seven Gibeonites had perished, probably thousands upon thousands of them had perished, but seven was a perfect number, and seven people would be hanged, the descendants of Saul. And there's a lesson in this, because God will not have it that his kingdom, and therefore his name, is put to shame by the unseemly, wicked, evil conduct of his people. And so the time comes when he indicates to David, no more. There'll be famine in the land. You're in grinding poverty. It's 3 years, and it won't stop until this wrong is righted, because my name has been disgraced before all the nations by what Saul did, and what I believe his handful of descendants were probably still doing. Well, the people of Israel should have reacted to this much sooner. This should have been put right years before, because the name of God had been besmirched and ruined, and so the whole thing had to be dealt with. And if the church is brought into disrepute today, that's a terrible thing. If there's sin and shameful things happen, and foolish things which discredit the cause of Christ, sometimes doctrinal things like this prosperity gospel, the worldlings can see through it. All this nonsensical teaching that makes the Church of Jesus Christ look ridiculous in the eyes of the world. Well, God will hold the people responsible, and he'll hold us responsible if we do things which put to shame the gospel. Well, dear friends, I hope at least that very brief comment makes sense of what happens in this chapter, where life has to be forfeit because of what Saul did to the Gibeonites. The issue is the shame brought upon the message of God. Well, just the opening verses of chapter 22, most of which becomes the 18th psalm. David spake unto the Lord the words of this song in the day that the Lord had delivered him out of the hand of all his enemies and out of the hand of Saul. And he said, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, the God of my rock. In him will I trust." We've seen tonight David making some mistakes. Sometimes people say, what is chapter 22 doing here in 2 Samuel? Why is this psalm recorded right here? Does it fit here chronologically? No, it doesn't. Then why, under the inspiration of God, has the compiler of the book put it in here? And my guess is that this is the answer. That we've read about some weaknesses of David. And we need a corrective. We need an insight into the normal state of David's heart and what kind of a godly man and a leader he was. And so this is inserted. His great indebtedness to God and his trust in God. And people sometimes say, I've heard it said, yes, but the 18th Psalm or 2 Samuel chapter 22 is a very self-righteous psalm. David spends a number of verses saying, God has rewarded me according to my righteousness, and things like that. And we, because we're saved by grace and we're taught the lessons of grace, we find that kind of talk rather disturbing. But we have to understand what David means. He is not saying, I'm sure, I have lived a perfect life, I am a fine person, I deserve all kinds of rewards and blessings. No, he's simply saying this. He doesn't actually use these words, but he's saying this. For all my faults and my mistakes and my falls, I follow the Lord. And I want his way. And I serve him. And I live to please him. And I wish I'd been far better. But I don't worship idols, I worship the true God. And I cleave to him with all my faults. Read it that way. And the righteous, that is those who are saved, whose eyes are on heaven, who stand for the Lord, who struggle against their sin and seek to please him, they are the people who God will reward. Read David in that sense. And it's a wonderful psalm, a wonderful song, and it helps restore the balance of the man of faith after reading of some of his mistakes. May God help us with this tremendous record. Let's close the scene.